Bird Dog is 7% alcohol.
Well, I have an old fashioned and then a bottle of Tasmanian whiskey lit next to me. So I may be ready for a...
All you need is an electric bike and a couple of cartoons to you can... Did you ever read that? The book that Kadelka and First Dog wrote about their...
No.
Whiskey junket?
It's not bad.
It's an old bird book. I got it. Even though First Dog has blocked Dr. Yobbo on Twitter, for reasons I have no idea.
He's pretty, yeah, pretty strident in some of his views.
Fractious, I think I'd run with.
Cheap whiskey is terrible. Terrible. Anyway. Yes, this is actually Lawnmower Fuel, and it tastes pretty bad. I need to go and put some mixer in this.
And that's the only thing. Please hold. Your call is important to us. I've really only got a quarter of a... I should probably go get another beer, but this is strong enough that I shouldn't. People shouldn't drink, really. It's bad for them. I mean, you, listener. You're pouring poison in yourself. And let's face it, you're terrible company when you're drunk.
Oh, that's better.
Now available in 2-Stroke.
Fuck. Be lucky to be a 2-Stroke, that stuff. Anyway, I took notes this week for the After Dark.
You took notes.
I'm quite proud of myself.
Which disproves the theory that you can't write, which is Queensland's like an education system. It's on fire. So, New Zealand Music Month still hasn't fucking finished, despite everyone who listens to this podcast wishing it had. And we review albums that are new and albums that are not on this podcast because we feel like we've got the authority to do that because we're white men, so fuck off.
Look, if we were multimillionaires, we'd probably be much more of a dick than we already are.
We'd be abusing highly credentialed female nanotechnologists right now just because... I heard the word nano in an advertisement for fucking cosmetics once, and therefore I believe nano didn't mean anything.
Let's start with I Am Giant, which I
Let's
think,
start with I Am Groot.
Which I think lives...
I Am Groot?
I think lives up to its album art quite nicely. Like, if I
look... I Am Giant.
If I...
See, when I saw this, I immediately thought I Am Specialized, because... this joke is so niche, no one's gonna get it. But Giant make bicycles.
Yes, yes.
Specialized make bicycles. And Specialized tagline is I Am Specialized. So I assumed I Am Giant is just a fucking similar tagline. But no, what they are is a, as we said last week, they are the spin-off side project of a kind of a new metal band of the aughts of New Zealand extraction. And this is what they sound like. And their album is called Life in Captivity. And it looks like an angel exploding underwater.
I don't know how much you read.
I love the exasperated sigh.
No, it's not exasperated sigh.
Get with this.
There's a movie kicking around based on a series of Russian books called Night Watch, Day Watch, Twilight Watch, I think, are the three books. So anyway, the movie's okay. It's just sort of standard.
Apple Watch.
Standard. Yes, that's the fourth.
Day Watch.
Fourth one.
Neighborhood Watch.
It's sort of a... You know, the movie's sort of like a standard fantasy adaptation, but the books are very... Look, every time I try and explain them to someone, I go, they're very Russian.
It's very cold and it rains all the time.
No, it's just... I don't know. It's like
Own Chelsea Football Club.
You read this book, and it is a completely different experience from reading Western fantasy. It's just different. It's so Russian. It just bleeds Russia out of the pages.
Like, and bleak?
Yeah, bleak, but even there's something about the style. It's just, it's very hard to explain, but as soon as you read it, it's like,
they fucking kill everyone.
You feel like drinking vodka, and it's a little bit like Hardwood Proxim's Twitter feed, actually. It's quite nihilistic.
It's just so bleak and pointless that you may as well just open up a vein or Twitter a lot.
But that's how I feel about this style of music. And I listened to quite a bit of hardcore music when I was at the Rev. And I really enjoy 80% of this music. And the bit where he goes, I just does my fucking head in. Yep. I do not like that. Yeah. That the last 20% just does it for me.
How to ruin a perfectly functional riff. Scream like a fucking pathetic emo teenager when you're 40 years old. These guys are old. They have got no business. They're too old for emo. They're too old for fucking hardcore. It is just miss me with the angst. Miss me with the screamy angst. The dad won't let me borrow the car. Fuck off.
But the thing is, I actually think...
Fuck right off. Keep fucking off when you get there.
I think the other 80%, like, the riffs are awesome. The melodies are awesome. The rest of the music is fucking... His singing when he's not screaming is actually pretty good. It's just...
It's solid as shit. I mean, the bones of it are generic commercial rock radio, you know, whatever that is in 2018. But it's solid. It's just based... The bones are solid, but... Yeah. It's just so fucking whiny and earnest. There's no... It's a little bit like that. I talked about that... probably a different genre entirely, I suppose, but that Judas Priest album that was just so po-faced. It was so dedicated to being miserable and angry and, you know, death and destruction and, you know, demons and shit. And it's like there's no... There's only the slightest shaft of sunlight in this fucking, except for the fact they did a cover of Dragon's Reign, which is probably the only New Zealand thing about this fucking album. The fact that they covered another New Zealand band that nobody knew was a New Zealand band because they sung about the April Sun in fucking Cuba. But they've kind of done a hat tip to another unrecognisably Kiwi band by covering their song. And all that reminded me of was the fact that there was this montage they used to do from, I think it was the 1989 Formula One Grand Prix in Adelaide that was where it pissed down all the time. And they very cleverly used Rain by Dragon, It's Been Raining for So Long, as the song to put the montage of Formula One cars spinning and crashing and spinning and crashing and all that sort of stuff. So that's how little I engaged with this album. I started thinking about Wild Water Sports Formula One montages from the late 80s.
I recently went to Under 8's Day at my eldest's primary school, and there was a kid there who...
But you're not under 8.
I'm not under 8 yet.
How did you get in?
I ducked my head under.
Were they checking IDs?
No, not checking IDs. Didn't notice that I had a full facial beard. But there was a kid that just had a complete fucking meltdown, wanted one of the teachers, and this teacher was running, like, activities for 60 kids and was like, sorry, dude, I can't come and talk to you right now.
I'm not your mum.
And just went fucking off, you know, off chops, threw everything in the bin, just full tanty. And I was like, this reminds me of this album. That's what it reminded me of. Just
reminds me of the entire
someone
genre.
Fucking losing it completely. Yeah, that's what it was like.
That
visceral fucking scream. And I was like, I've heard this set to music.
About it. It's just visceral fucking angst. It's just, but it's not, there's no force behind it. There's no implied threat. There's no anger. It's just patheticness. It's just a...
The funny thing is like my notes for this week was, I do not like the screaming. And yet in the first track of Skinny Hobos...
I do not like it, Sam I Am.
There is... I don't know whether it's quite screaming, but it's close. Yet I find that adds to that song, that first song in the Skinny Hobos album. It doesn't detract from it.
We'll get the Skinny Hobos in time. I think we need to put these guys to bed. I am Groot. I'm Specialized. I mean, the best song of this album is probably Famous Parasite, which is probably the least screamy songs on the album. It kind of feels like they got it all out of their system by the time they got to the Dragon cover and just sort of moved out. But I was disappointed that Sex, Sex, Sex was as terrible as it was, because Sex was, as James Hunt observed, the breakfast of champions. But at least, I mean, the one positive you can say about this album is that it's not as bad as Blindspot, which was the band that gestated I Am Giant, who were an awful new metal band. So I'd say that this is not quite as awful as the most awful genre in the history of music. So congratulations, I Am Giant. Now fuck off, because this was their last ever album and I don't think they'll be missed. More like Life in Craptivity. See what I did there? It's very subtle.
So,
Skinny Hobos, this is their first album. They've never done an album before.
Okay, interesting.
And they actually played, I think they played a few on, because I'm Giant toured to say fuck off, to say good night, thanks for coming. And I think Skinny Hobos might have played on their undercard. But they're one of these, there's a cluster of young New Zealand bands that are getting a little bit of buzz from rock radio and various other places. Skinny Hobos, Baker's Eddie, Dead Favors. There's a few others that are kind of getting a bit of attention as well, but this is their they're an Auckland band, I think. Given that their second track is called Queen Street, I think they're an Auckland band. Although their third track is named after a bumfuck tiny cow town in the middle of the South Waikato called Tirau, but happens to be where you turn off if you're going from Hamilton to Rotorua or Hamilton to Taupo. It's where the two of them to bridge. There's a fact you weren't expecting to hear tonight.
Yes,
Skinny Hobos. What can you tell me about your experience with the hobos that are skinny? Well, give it away. You know you gotta go by yourself. And give it away. You know you'll never be somebody else. To get a reaction from you now, you know I gotta shout. To get a reaction from you now, you know I gotta shout. How long will you stay helpless now? Gotta take your pills. You wanna kiss your fill.
I think I've enjoyed this album a little bit less every time I've listened to it. Almost like, I really dug this album the first time. I thought it was a real good sort of slow burn. Is rock the right term?
Definitely. It's a relatively conventional modern rock album. If I told you they were a two-piece, would that change your perception of them? Because when I first I listened to the first couple of songs, and then I looked them up and I went, oh, no, they're a two-piece, like Raw Blood.
Yeah, I was gonna say,
sound like Raw Blood, and then track three is very Raw Bloody. I thought, okay, no, I can see that.
I would have been surprised, except that Raw Blood has really reset my expectations of what a two-piece can do.
Yeah,
in terms of depth kind of sound, bass, yeah.
That resonant fucking bass guitar heavy kind of sound, that kind of distorted, almost like Lemmy from Motorhead kind of playing the bass with a pick kind of noise.
Yeah, it's a great sound.
I'm a big fan of it, and it seems to be a lot of other people are big fans of it because they keep making bands where they do that sort of thing.
I put it on my shortlist just because. I listened to this about five times this week, and I got a little bit sick of it by the end.
I suppose you could say it's got limited instrumentation. I mean, the songs generally sound the same because you've got a.
But I never got sick of the Raw Blood albums. So I put it on. I can't. It's like a niche that I can't scratch.
You like the wrong one.
Yeah, that's true. I do like the second one much more than the first.
Which is baffling to me because the second one is just Muse areas. I think if I went back and listened to it, I wouldn't hate it as much as we do. But I know Albion Loveden's with me on this one because we've talked about it. Is that because we like the first one so much, it's kind of it's always going to be in the shadow of the other one, whereas you've got the reverse situation where the first one is in the shadow of the second because that's the order in which you heard them.
Yeah.
Track 4 is called Number 3, and that's ridiculous. I think that should be banned. That doesn't make any sense.
I found this extremely enjoyable on the first listen. I just thought this was a lot of fun. Like, it just had a great sort of upbeat vibe to it, even though it was quite slow.
The first track is super slow.
Yeah, and then it kicks in. Yeah, I love that change of pace.
Is much more. Sorry, I think I'm talking over you. Blame the internet. The sound of the second half of track one is much more reflective of what's to come.
Yep. It's almost like a really extended introduction.
Yeah.
Like Dire Straits used to do that, where they do this huge sort of massive slow build-ups to songs and then kick into what they actually wanted to do. And
Long intro to Money for Nothing, I Want My MTV, is a good example of that.
I think these
guys are obviously a lot less produced.
I think the first track is my favourite track off this album because of that sort of contrast of that slow build-up and then that explosion into the sort of joyous rocking part of it. Like, I could just see them.
Yeah.
Like, can you imagine that at a live show? Like, obviously that slow start would be extended out to really build the crowd up, and then just to kick into their set would be, you know, that would be, I could just admit, that would be an amazing thing.
I'd be interested to see them, and because they, imagine being a two-piece, they'd kind of be more inclined to play intimate venues. My favorite track on the album is probably Merchant of Terrell, which is track 3, and Suburban Living, which is, I think it was the track that was on my release radar that told me the album was out. I really fucking like these band. I really enjoy it. Now, I don't know how much of that is because I know they're locals, I know they're Kiwis, and the whole point of New Zealand Music Month is to find cool local stuff that you can go, yeah, they're singing about, and there is local time and place in this. There are songs about that have relevance to the New Zealand experience. Much more so than most of the bands that we've listened to in this month. This is a good album. I don't know. It doesn't push the boat out.
Yeah, it was so far
that we can't see the boat anymore.
It was solid, and it was such a solid, good album, but not memorable.
I've got to the stage just today where. Songs, you know, when you get to a stage of an album where the songs start popping into your head unsolicited.
Yep.
And so I'm at that stage now, and I know that an album has wormed its way in when it's at that.
Yeah.
And I'll like little bits of the riffs will pop in. And it's usually Merchant of Terror or Suburban Living. But yeah, it's really. I mean, we've had some good albums so far this year. So, but I think, you know, it's a definite shot for a top five. And I think I'm not gonna lie. Part of that's because they get a hometown bonus. You know, they get some home court advantage. Mm. But just if you know, it's just the same as if a great young Australian band popped up that cranked out a great album, they'd get an advantage too. Because I want to push music that's from my homes. But this is a really good album. And I might just take a sidestep here. I mentioned that there's a bit of a cluster of bands of New Zealand bands that are out that are doing cool stuff. Another band that I always confuse these guys with called Baker's Eddy. They have an EP out. They're a little bit more punk, sort of pop punky, but they've got an EP out. It was a bit too short to pick as an album. We're now right at the end of May, and I don't think we're going to be doing any more New Zealand Music Month picks, but... if you come across their EP, which is called I'm Not Making Good Decisions, give that a spin because it's actually really good.
So, the classic... Look Sharp.
Sharp.
So this album was big in my consciousness at the time.
Yeah. So you were about, what, 10 when this album? I suppose when The Look. The Look.
11.
This is the... We might, I'll do my little fucking rock historian bullshit. What?
Talking like a man, hitting like a hammer, she's a juvenile scam. Never was a quitter, tasted like a raindrop. She's got the look. Heavenly bomb, cause heaven's got a number when she's spinning me around. Kissing is a collar, her loving is a wild dog. She's got the look. She's got the look.
She's got the look.
She's got the look.
She's got the look.
What in the world can make a brown eyed girl turn blue? When everything I'll ever do, I do for you. And I go la 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 la. She's got the look.
So these guys were both in, they were kind of in musical acts in Sweden. Swedish language acts. The dude, Per Gessler, was in like a two-piece dude band, and Marie Fredriksson was a female solo artist. More kind of folk than this. And they got together and they started doing English language pop stuff in the early 80s, in sort of the mid-80s. And how this album broke internationally was that EMI had actually listened to it and passed it up and said, nah, we're not interested. But an American exchange student from Minneapolis had been over in Sweden and had got the album there, brought it back home, took it into his local radio station and said, fuck, you should play this. This is really cool. And the radio station picked up the look and started spinning it. And then all the other stations in that kind of network started spinning it. And that was how the look became a pop hit in 1989, which was a year after the album came out.
Imagine that that's just not... Like
that
story is just impossible to imagine now, isn't it? Like, yeah. If you told that to someone who was 18 now, they would just look at you like you're a crazy person.
Like, how come? Why didn't they just put it on SoundCloud?
Yeah,
people pick it up. Yeah. Exactly. It's but that was how it went. And because this local station was part of a network, the rest of the network started picking it up all around America, and then a big label picked them up, and they suddenly became a thing. The look came out in 89. It must have been about the age of my eldest son, actually. And I've always remembered the film clip, which was very neon colours and flashy, angular kind of looks. And this very staccato, very contemporary kind of sound beat. You know, it was very...
It feels
incredibly 80s listening to it, because that's literally what it is. It struck me...
Did you put the link for Big Pig's... film clip in last week's show notes?
Oh, we didn't actually. No, we didn't.
You got to throw that up. I showed that to Vanessa this week and she was just completely baffled.
it looks... Well, I remember seeing them on the big gig, I think.
Yeah.
I remember seeing them doing it live on the big gig.
Full costume.
Kind of thing.
Yeah.
There was a whole lot of people doing performance art in the background, basically. But these guys, well, this pair, I think they were much more of a sort of a post-new wave guitar effects driven pop band than a synth pop band. I know that you were pulling up the example of maybe this was the band that inspired the rule. And I think really when you pull up what they did, they were just doing guitar pop.
Yeah. I think they're singles maybe, but there's not as much synth as I remember in this.
Yeah.
The problem I've got with this album is... And, like, I picked this as the classic.
You picked this as the classic.
Not necessarily.
You picked this as a classic album. I know, actually, no, that's not fair, because at this stage of the podcast's
I was 12
life
or
cycle,
11.
We're no longer really talking about classic albums that have meant a shitload to us. We might still have a few of those as we go, but really what we're talking about now is albums that were huge in a period or... We're reevaluating the place of albums in the context that they exist. And in this case, this was one of the biggest albums of the late 80s and
yep.
sort of defined a sound. And we're kind of digging into whether that sound needed to be defined or whether they really did define that sound.
I actually think this is a classic Adam H. Photo album because the drop...
Well, he's even said so. He was wetting his pants about the idea that
The drop-off from the singles to the rest of the album is pretty sharp.
Dramatic.
Like,
it's
there's something...
It's like going off the edge of a Norwegian fjord.
There's something about the singles that just have a little bit more life to them, like a little bit more depth. Like, the rest of the album is pretty...
the rest of the album are just kind of less well-formed versions of the same song.
Yeah,
And it reminded me a lot, and you'll remember this, because when Adam picked it as a classic album... That fucking Def Leppard album from about the same, from 1987, had the same problem. It had a shitload of really good singles. And then the rest of the album was songs that were not quite good enough to be singles, but were pretty much, you know, slightly diced up copies of the other songs on the album. And so that's pretty much what this, what's the problem with Look Sharp as an album is. It's got some fucking, I mean, the opening single, The Look, is still a fucking banger.
Yeah, it's, the singles
30 years after it was written.
Are really, really well constructed pop songs, I have to say.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, it's incredibly 80s, but it's built off and the whole album is built around some fucking really solid electronic drums.
Mm.
And undressed for some sex, as we used to call it in the playground. And it's basically Louie / Wild Thing chord progressions. But the problem is that the album's so long that there's so many non-singles, they don't really hold up.
Well, what I did the second and third times I listened to this album to make myself more entertained was I tried to imagine some of these non-singles in late 80s, early 90s Eddie Murphy or Tom Cruise movies. So,
or Pretty Woman, because, of course, they did the lead single for the Pretty Woman album, which is not on this album or the next one.
So Sleeping
I should point out, if you listen to the whole album, you did yourself a disservice because the album actually stopped at Listen to Your Heart.
Mm.
Anything after that was extra shit they tacked on for 2009.
So Sleeping Single is definitely a car ride montage from an Eddie Murphy movie, going to a new city, driving around, you know, looking at the kids doing crazy things, laughing, probably in a convertible. Shadow of a Doubt.
With a woman with enormous hair.
Shadow of a Doubt is like a bedroom scene. You know, the guy standing in an open window with the wind blowing the curtains, looking at a woman sleeping after they've had sex. That's definitely Shadow of a Doubt. And then I think, what was the other one? Chances.
Chances was a terrible fucking early 90s Channel 9 soap opera that was full of tits.
Chances is definitely the sort of riff and the chorus is when, you know, he's going to rescue his love interest in a warehouse and there's probably lots of bad guys with, you know, South African accents.
Diplomatic community.
So, I really enjoy this album fitting
Elon
the rest
Musk
of
is South African. That tells you all you need to know about him.
Fitting the rest of this album to bad late 80s movies. I thought that was.
Well, I think you've probably got more. You've found the way to get the most value out of it. What about Paint Your Love? That sounds more like it might be some sort of whitewash. The problem is, I mean, the album is long and. And then that was the thing in the 80s. Everyone wanted to get value out of it. But there's so much stuff in here that maybe didn't need to happen.
Yeah.
I kept coming back to the idea that I was thinking this was going to be more of a synth album. And it really is a guitar-driven album, even if it is very effects-y. And the guitar sound is unbelievably clean. It's that very,
it's
very,
very
it's so pristine. Zach Lowe talks about it in terms of its spacing. It's an NBA niche joke that only you and I will get. And you'll only get it when you listen back to it because the sound broke up. It's, you know, the problem with it is, if you go back and you look at the reviews in period, the consensus was that the album, the non-single tracks weren't filler, but they certainly weren't killer.
Yeah.
And the interesting thing is that Joyride, the album that came later, which was done under much more pressure because they were trying to follow up a big hit, was both much better reviewed critically and sold more. So if you were going to say any and having listened to it again, it's got much more range. You know, it's not just in this very narrow kind of guitar / synth pop space. There's rock songs and there's fucking soul songs and there's even folk songs. So even if you were going to say any Roxette album is a classic, I would argue it's probably Joyride
rather than this.
Same formula but just better areas, better done.
I think I just picked this one because this was the one that affected me the most. Like, I can really remember these singles coming out. I can remember those film clips.
The one that affected me the most was Wendy James from Transition Vamp, but that was a different problem.
Mm. All right.
But I was going to go and listen to Transition Vamp to see whether they had anything good to offer. But the thing is that because they were all on the pop charts together, you tend to conflate them, but they were a totally different sort of band. They were an alternative rock band.
Not a
pop act
like,
at all.
So. They were almost like sex rock, weren't they? Transition band.
Well, they were a rock band. You know, they had guitars and, you know, they would have been like the Baby Animals.
Yeah.
you know, much more than fucking. Oh. Whereas Roxette were more like Indecent Obsession.
Yes. I just thought of a good one for a classic that I hadn't thought of before. Anyway, I have two Australian albums for my new. Well, actually, I have one and a half Australian albums for my new.
You know, it's New Zealand Music Month when the Australians just come in and claim.
That's right. So, you're going to be very happy with me, but I have an album that is a. There's a band called the Mess Hall, which I quite liked, and
yes. And the Mess Hall and the Mess Hall are not dissimilar to, you know, again, bluesy two-piece.
Yep.
Sound different to the Skinny Hobos, but there's kind of a, you know, they were in that kind of White Stripes, Black Keys kind of sounding space-ish thing in that same kind of period.
This is not that sound. This is a slow core. This is a slow core album.
So if you like that, don't listen to this.
This is a slow core album from one of the guys, I think it's the drummer from the Mess Hall, the guitarist from Deer Hunter, and a female vocalist. It's called Roadhouses. It's a debut album, I would imagine, because it's self-titled.
Multiple Patrick Swayze.
Yeah, popped up on my Discover Weekly, so we'll have a look at that. There was a really funny. Did I tell you about the post from? I think I did tell you. Catch had his own song pop up on his Discover Weekly last week.
Yeah, we referenced that in the show notes. That you just Discover Yourself Weekly.
Yeah, that's right. And the other one is an EP. I know we don't technically class EPs as albums.
Well, I should have done that fucking Baker's Eddie EP rather than that I Am Giant album, because the I Am Giant album was Toilet.
Yep.
And the Baker's Eddie EP was really good.
But gives us a way to review Camp Cope without actually reviewing Camp Cope.
We're not allowed to review Camp Cope,
but this is not Camp Cope.
And we're not allowed to make a big deal out of it because that's douchey.
But this is not Camp Cope. This is Dan Sultan. Dan Sultan has an EP out called Killer Under a Blood Moon. It's featuring Meg Mac, AB Original, Camp Cope, and others. It's a 6-track EP. I quite like Dan Sultan, and I'm obviously a big supporter of AB Original, so let's have a listen to that and see what that's like.
I thought you hated Briggs because he's sweaty. I don't know.
No,
I did like Trials.
Out of the two, I like Trials. Okay. Yeah. But look, I'm keen to support him, and I like Dan Sultan, so let's listen to that.
I like Briggs' hustle. I really respect that.
Yeah, yeah.
He's got a fucking Matt Groening fucking supported cartoons.
How cool is that? That's fucking awesome. All right. So what
fucking talented boy, that one. Talented boy.
What have you got for me that's a classic?
It is the final week of New Zealand Music Month, so I thought we might visit a band that we kind of sort of done a classic album of, but it was under a different name and it was a live album, which is an entire cop-out. And if you do a live album as a classic album, really you're setting aside the whole idea that albums are meant to be a time capsule of time and place and all that sort of shit. So I thought we might go back to 1999. And we might visit a band called Sheehad and an album called The General
Electric. Good.
Because that's a really good album. They did quite a lot of really good albums in the 90s before they turned into Pacifier and went total fucking cheese in a can, trying to break into the American market and failing. But The General Electric was an album that just ripped Sheehad open in Australia. They just suddenly went from being a fringe thing that you might remember being talked about, you know, late night on the metal show on Triple J, to being all up and
huge,
down, fucking all like, over the shop.
Like everywhere. I remember like seeing everywhere. Them at Livid, and I was trying to work out the other day. It's like
probably 3 o'clock in the afternoon because that was Sheehad o'clock.
How many Livids did I actually go to? Because I sort of vaguely remember Livid as this thing that you just went to, even though, like, because I have no sense of your like I was definitely not the rock historian or into specific, like I can remember going to Livid and only really going to Livid for Resin Dogs or The Herd, or, you know, not having like a full, like by the time I got Splinter in the Grass.
It was just like a really expensive gig.
Yeah, like by the time
I got. It wasn't even that expensive because it was like fucking.
Yeah.
$60 or something.
Yeah, but look, by the time I got Splinter in the Grass, I'd sort of mapped out my day. You know, I want to see this and I want to see, you know, I developed my taste enough that I knew. But like Livid, I just used to wander around and. If I heard
because the grounds were fucking amenable to that.
Yeah, if I heard something I liked,
I went 2000, 01, 02, 03, and that was the end of Livid, I think. So I went because I moved to Brisbane in 2000,
yeah,
as long as they had one.
So I moved to Brisbane in 96. I wouldn't have gone in 96, I don't think, but I think I would definitely would have gone in 97. Because I can remember, I can sort of remember that Livid was something that you say you made sure you had enough money for the ticket for, but I guess I went to a whole heap of Livids and didn't really take enough of it in.
It's probably because you were off your fucking chops.
Yeah, that there's a possibility of that. Yes, absolutely.
Which is the point of going to a festival. Sniffer Dogs outside festivals are fucking fascism.
The other thing is I think that 2011 Livid sits so heavily across my consciousness that it sort of blanks out everything else. Like I've just got such good memories of that festival that, yeah, nothing else.
I've got really clear memories of that one, and I've got because of the half crowd and the fact that it was so chill and the fact you could just wander around, which was also no good for their bottom line. But the year before was the 40 degrees – ridiculously stacked lineup. The Cure are playing, so every goth in southeast Queensland.
Yeah,
in fact, a friend of mine who grew up in Brisbane flew back from Sydney.
Goth and Brisbane really don't go well together.
Well, this is the thing. So my friend who grew up in Brisbane was in Sydney because we'd been flatmates in Sydney. She flew back to Brisbane because the Cure were playing, and she was all goth and. It was 40 degrees and all these goths were fucking melting. The dedication to the bit is just, you just can't underestimate how impressive that is, that how fucking dedicated to the bit you have to be a goth in Brisbane when it's 39 degrees and there's 44,000 people at the RNA showgrounds. So impressive. But I mean, that's the reason I went to Livid was because my friend was coming up to go to see the Cure and I thought, fuck, I'll come too.
I don't think I saw the Cure that Livid though.
No, I didn't see the Cure because fuck the Cure, they're terrible. Mm. But that year, that was fucking Blink 182 and Green Day and just this massive shitload of huge international acts. Plus all the Australian ones like, you know, Silverchair, Grinspoon, fucking The Living End, Regurgitator. You know, all, you know, it was pretty much everyone you'd possibly expect to go to a festival. That was my first. I think that was basically my first festival because I didn't go to any in Sydney. And that was fucking awesome. But festivals are for young people. So enjoy festivals, young people.
Well, there used to be festivals for, like, they tried. What was the one they tried for?
They've got plenty of festivals for old people. They've got Day on the Green.
Day on the Green. No, they tried one at River Stage for a while.
Well, they had like the V Festival, which was all. In fact, they've got like Download Festival, which is kind of commercial rock and metal, which is meh.
Nah, this one was like trip hop and it was more like beats for old people, I guess.
Imagine why that wasn't sustainable.
It was like Portishead and Massive Attack, and you know, you bought picnics and sat down and, you know, probably smoked a joint and chilled out. But
dropped a shitload of ketamine and
that was the one. There was a promoter that he had a whole raft of sort of niche festivals. It wasn't actually that one that killed him. It was
AJ Matter, was it?
No, it might have been a punk one or something. There was one that went particularly pear shaped, didn't sell any tickets. Might have been one of the, you know, shirts off, guns out festivals that went badly. Because there was
when do they ever go anything other than badly?
Well, I think there was that. The problem was that there was. You know, competing circuit of those, you know, there was quite a bit of competition for those in
the
that space.
The preening dickhead circus.
Yeah. Oh, look, what my best mate, his brother, who's the nicest guy in the world, when he was single, that was his life, was for 10 months of the year, he would eat egg whites and fucking chicken breast and go to the gym 7 days a week and just fucking get himself absolutely ripped so he could go and take drugs and get his shirt off at a festival. But the problem was that fucking everyone was good looking, ripped, and had their shirt off at a festival. So it was like, you know, essentially being like in a large school of sardines. You know.
Well, yeah, you just end up being just a whole lot of, you know, literally looking like a fucking a rack of sausages that's come out from under the grill.
Mm.
Just this weird lump of fucking oiled flesh. It just, you don't actually look like a human being.
And he actually played because he was in our social touch team and we loved playing with him, but he ended up stopping playing because he missed a couple of weeks leading into a festival because he tweaked an ankle and couldn't go to the gym. And it was like, no, you know.
It ruined
festival season. So, look, I admired the commitment because, fuck, you know, at this age, it's hard to have that sort of commitment for anything other than getting up and looking after the kids in the morning. So
what you're saying is you respect the kind of weird, nuggety, pinging munters who would barge past you. Didn't you say that ruined one of your festivals or something?
But that was
cape wearing fucking shirtless.
Yeah, that was
weirdly
big day out though.
Chest shaven, lumpy, walnut looking dude came fucking barreling through you. And you thought, fuck this, I'm going home.
Yeah, look, that's big day out. I'm quite happy for them
that's
to have
true.
It. I'm
that
quite
was a
happy for that.
Space. I mean, Livid was a much more welcoming space than
well, look,
Big Day Out.
I'm all for,
as we've said 57 times on this fucking podcast,
I'm all for, you know, niche groups having their own festival. Like, if everyone wants to get super fucking ripped and take ecstasy and jump around and try and pick up girls, then sure, have a festival for that.
I didn't at any stage think that trying to pick up girls was part of the equation because it was mostly about hanging out with other men.
Yeah, that's true.
I assumed it was a comfortable place for guys who were a bit not quite sure about their positioning to be comfortable with each other. And I'm sure all of them were in there for that, but that certainly seemed to be a major motivation.
Yeah, there's definitely a bit of a bro.
It was.
Bro code
kind of,
feeling to it, but there
that,
was
that
also
kind of bromo eroticism. Mm. If that makes any sense, that kind of there's a certain kind of when brohood gets closest to basically be a platonic gay relationship.
We have
kind of what that looked like.
We have really gone off in the weeds at this podcast, haven't we?
We have not. We've just explaining things to future generations.
Oh,
you nude up, oil up, buff up, and bust out your guns around a bunch of other men. Look, some men might interpret that in a way, but you might not like. But you might, and if you do, that's cool.
If I had guns, and you know, if I didn't have to shave for 19 hours to get smooth enough to oil up, then maybe I'd be into it as well.
You'd have to fucking someone would have to hose you down with nads, the fucking hair depilatory shit. All I wanted to do was wear a shirt that said rock and roll motherfucker and just go out and fucking give it the horns, watching some band give it fucking heaps. That's all I needed. Because let's face it, the girls aren't in the middle of that fucking seething mass of weird sausage dudes.
Mm.
They're just not, because they're going to get smashed by some fucking
munter with
0% body fat.
Yeah, that's right. All the guys have got too big of guns to be fucking in the mosh pit with them.
Because they're just ricocheting off each other like in a ball pit. There's no give. A bunch of dudes with like 0.05% body fat and they're all fucking munting around together. You get in the middle of that, it's like being put in a fucking grinder.
It gives a whole new meaning to the word pingers, doesn't it? Is ping off each other.
Yeah, literally fucking pinging off each other. Like ball bearing.
Oh, dear. All right, Doc.
Speaking of balls, this was the Balls After Dark podcast we do after the podcast we do. I was the Doc. He was Bezo. Next week, we're going to review some other albums that aren't these ones. If you enjoy what we do, check out the album lists on Spotify. Follow us on socials.
Give us your feedback on Roxette.
Fucking back announce you can imagine. But Well, Sonic from the back.
I don't know. Have you listened to some of our back announcers? They're pretty low-key. All right. See you, Doc. And I will not stop recording until I close the laptop. Oh, that was funny.
Is it the first time I've been watching too much Deezer's Marrow? It's like, suck my dick from the back. Which is not something that makes any sense unless you watch a lot of them.
Oh, dear. That Beck piece was excellent.
What a Beck.
It's really interesting. Pat, you know, Pat, my mate Pat, he is so fucking... does not like Draymond.
Anti-Draymond, yeah.
And yet, he's the exact sort of player that Draymond is. Underappreciated outside of his own team. Does not have a traditional skill set. I don't think Pat ever had Draymond's sort of motor. But... yeah, I just find it really funny how Pat sort of appreciates the classical gun players but doesn't understand the, you know, indispensable role player, which is essentially what he was for me as a player.
And all the percentage, all the little 5%ers that no one sees.
You know, people would say to me, why do you keep picking Pat? Because I'm like, oh, because he does these 9 things that no one else does. Which is, you know, what Kerr says, you know, that everyone at Golden State says, you know, we wouldn't fucking trade Draymond if you punch the... I'll tell you what, how much
Which is odd because he believed he was getting traded, and it's interesting that it's only been since the value of Draymond was explained to Draymond that he felt confident that he wasn't going to be turfed out.
How shit a job of Golden State's front office done this season? What the fuck are you doing with essentially... 4 guys that you do not play. McGee, like I know they played West a little bit, but McGee
But how much money are they spending on those guys? I think that because they are shopping, they are scraping out the bargain bin.
Yeah, but like they cut Omni Caspery, right, who's a defensive. Yeah,
that was a bad call.
Like, why did you not cut
McGee? To get cropped.
But why did you not cut McGee or Zaza? Like, those guys have not played almost a single minute in the whole fucking finals. You can't tell me you can't put Caspery out with Durant in those swaggy P minutes and go, look, just go and defend Chris Paul or James Harden for 4 minutes and let Durant score. Like, you don't have to be a gun offensive player. You just have to be okay defensively. So I can't understand Swaggy P on that side.
Nick Young's not as that hasn't really worked out. I mean, it was worked out okay, but I think because McCaw's been injured and because fucking Quinn Cook's, Quinn Cook's all right, but you know he bricked the shot that would have won them the game. Today.
But that's like their system. Their system says if you have that shot, you take it. What their system, like, that's what they teach.
But it looked like it, in the moment, it looked like it got real big on him. He suddenly realized, shit, somebody just passed me the ball to take this shot, and clankety clanks.
Mm. I know you don't like Game of Thrones, but the NBA 1K Game of Thrones today was pretty funny. Fultz behind him.
No, it wasn't.
Hiding behind the chair going, you want to come into the game? No. It was funny. Did you watch it?
Of course not. Why the fuck would I watch that?
I know. Oh, dear. If I wanted
to see something terribly written and not in any way funny, I'd read my own notes for this podcast.
All right. I'm off.
I'm just glad the writers of, you know, fucking 2.5 Men finally got another job.
Oh, wow. Wow. It's not that bad. It's not that bad. I like Game of Zones. I find it hilarious. Anyway, I'm off. All right, Doc. I'll get this up tomorrow.
You should get it up at some stage. Your wife will stop messaging me.
See ya.